M2Sys Technology and Right Patient Patient Identification sought to explore some of the current issues facing patient access managers in the modern healthcare environment. What are the challenges in patient identification? What risks does healthcare face due to patient misidentification? How are duplicate medical records affecting patient safety and the economic health of medical facilities? What can be done to prevent patient misidentification? We asked Nancy Farrington, the Enterprise Master Patient Index Administrator for Mainline Health in Broomall, Pennsylvania, who has over 30 years of experience in the patient access industry and is a former board member of the National Association of Healthcare Access Management, if she would spend some time with us to share her expertise, experience, and assessment of patient access in healthcare. The following podcast is a recording of our conversation.
Hi, this is John Trader with M2Sys Technology, and we are lucky today to have the opportunity to speak with Nancy Farrington. Nancy is a certified healthcare access manager for Mainline Health Systems and has over 30 years of experience in patient access. Today we are going to discuss the current state of patient identification in healthcare and ask Nancy for her feedback on some of the most pressing issues. Thanks for joining us today, Nancy.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you about this. It's a topic about which I am quite passionate and extremely interested, so I welcome the opportunity.
Let's jump into the first question. Nancy, in your opinion, what do you feel is really the number one challenge right now in patient identification?
I would say that across the country there are no established standards for what data to use for patient identification. There are commonly used ones, but none that are mandated by any authority, so that there's a lack of consistency in how information is collected. For example, do we or don't we use punctuation in names? Do we allow nicknames? Are generational titles a separate field or included as part of the last name? So this lack of consistency, there are no objective data standards. They're all determined by individual organizations. That in conjunction with the public's perception that they do not have any obligation to present a government-related identification at the time they receive hospital services contributes to the patient identification problem in healthcare.
Okay. What do you feel is the role that accurate patient identification plays in the healthcare industry's patient safety strategies?
Looking at the industry as a whole, there's a little bit of a vacuum on that. There is a Joint Commission standard that requires two patient identifiers at the time service is provided to the patient. However, that presumes that accurate patient identification has been done at the point of entry, that registration services and patient access services have done a thorough and complete job of determining whether the patient already had an existing record within that health system, and that the health, or if they find one, that it is unequivocally the patient, belongs to the patient whom they're registering. So the Joint Commission standard really only applies once the patient is in-house and being selected from a much smaller population than the population of the community as a whole, which is the population that is utilized when the patient is being registered. So there is no good, the only existing standard really takes a very small subset of the population. HIMSS is working on positive patient identification and has developed some materials related to it, and there is an arm of a coalition of people from HIMSS and many other healthcare organizations that are in the process of lobbying, or I shouldn't even say lobbying because we're not to the point of having anything specific to lobby for, but educating government officials about the need to do more related to patient identification. There's prohibition by tradition within Congress of creating a uniform healthcare ID. And there are a lot of schools of thoughts on whether or not that is essential, or developing other means of identifying patients would satisfy the requirements. But there are no, so there it comes back to the other thing, no real standards. There is growing awareness and discussion about that as an issue, not only within HIMSS, but within CHIME and other professional organizations, as well as it coming under the heading of other activity going on related to security. Like, INST has a little tiny piece of it. There's a lot of bodies that are thinking about it, but nothing is published, and obviously it's the foundation. Accurate patient identification is essential in patient safety, because if you're creating multiple records for the same individual, the treating providers do not have the complete health record, or if you erroneously select a record on another patient and provide treatment to them, you're in really serious trouble.
Okay.
Very long-winded answer. Sorry about that.
No, that's great. Thank you very much. We did see recently that the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons had said that patient identification was the number one patient safety issue on their list and recommendations for the industry. And I wanted to ask you, how important is it, or how much exposure do you feel that academies or associations like the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons identifying patient identification, how much does that bring to the awareness issue, to the clout of getting patient identification more front and center?
I would say that it is a rapidly growing area, that there are more and more people becoming aware of how critical an issue it is, but there isn't penetration or understanding of depth within organizations or even on professional levels. CHIME recently did a study, though, where they, the CIOs that contributed to the study estimated that 19% of the hospitals involved in the study had an adverse patient mismatch in the past year. So that's a pretty critical number. There's a part of me that thinks we're going to be just like years ago when we saw all the work coming out of National Institute of Health related to patient safety and errors. I think that this is going to start becoming more and more of an issue, especially as HIEs grow.
Okay, thank you. We have already touched a little bit about the risks of patient identification, misidentification to patients. Can you talk to me just for a minute about what some of the financial implications of patient misidentification are to healthcare?
Oh, absolutely. It's significant, and again, to a large extent, even the most benign misidentification issue, which is most typically the creation of a duplicate record, has a significant financial implication. And there are estimates that, if we use a very conservative estimate, somewhere between $20 and $25 per duplicate for, and that's on a record that doesn't have a lot of clinical data associated with it. That's just, you know, basically talking of looking at financial records or potentially like an outpatient lab visit. It's going to cost somewhere between $20 and $25 to remediate between the research and the corrections in all of the various computer systems that have gotten the wrong ADT information. So when you multiply that times the thousands of times a year that that happens across the healthcare system, you're going to find that I would not be at all surprised if this issue costs more than fraud, deliberate fraud, patient ID theft. I am personally convinced that it is more expensive than fraud, which obviously gets a lot more play in the media.
You're absolutely right. I was just going to say, you hear a lot more about medical identity fraud than you do about patient misidentification. So what you're saying is that, in your opinion, you feel that patient misidentification is actually not only a bigger issue, but has the potential to having a larger financial impact on the industry.
Yes, unequivocally, because it's unsung. People just go ahead and take care of it without really estimating what the costs are and figuring them out through the cost of the whole, even in an individual hospital. I can't tell you, as knowledgeable as I am about the process in my own organization, we have never really come up with a good dollar figure associated with it. There have been a couple of points where we did a little work on it, but then it was like, oh, instead of spending the time to do that, just fix them. Mm-hmm. I think that if we had good numbers, that it would be shocking. And I had hoped when Chime did their survey that that would be one of the things that they asked about. Apparently, they did not. And I think that even if they had asked, the CIOs would have been unable to answer because nobody's really done a real good, strong estimate on that. So, and that's just talking about the administrative costs associated with it. When you start figuring in costs related to duplication of care, so additional tests that are ordered or additional work that are done by physicians, Dr. B doesn't know that Dr. A analyzed to this particular clinical situation last week and all he would need to do would be to update it, or the cost to patients in terms of lost time, in terms of having studies repeated. In fact, one of the hospitals that's a member of NAHM several years ago now, before they started their EHR, did do a little bit of cost analysis. And again, not dollars and cents, but cost to the patient in terms of soft data. And some of what they found was that in addition to the patient having lost time, having had studies repeated that might not have been necessary, there was also additional cost because they led to things like, well, you can't have this test two times in a month. So they're having battles with their insurance companies, even though the tests had been ordered by the physician because one physician didn't know the other physician had done it. So there are big costs involved that are buried in other things. And then, of course, the worst case cost would be if there are, for those with adverse occurrences, if they lead to a lawsuit or loss of confidence by the community in that organization's ability to provide care. Charge card ad? Priceless.
Right.
Don't know what the costs are going to be. Inestimable.
You know, Nancy, that's something you said in there struck me, and that was that I myself didn't even realize that when you're factoring in the cost of patient misidentification to the industry overall, you have to factor in time for patients, as you pointed out, if they're ordered to have an additional test performed, for example, that another doctor had already ordered. That's something that has to be considered too. So that's a great point. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say the time it takes them to have the study repeated and mm-hmm. the transportation costs and all that associated with their lost time from work. And then in addition to add insult to injury, then the time they spend fighting with their insurance company because the insurance company doesn't want to pay the bill a second time.
Right. It's a very good point. You did touch just briefly on duplicate medical records, and you gave me some statistics about what the cost to the industry of duplicate medical records are. In your opinion, being an insider in patient identification in healthcare, how big of an issue do you see duplicate medical records being right now? Are we talking about an issue that's really getting serious attention, or is it just business as usual in terms of duplicate medical records?
don't think that it is getting the attention that it needs to get in the industry right now. I do think in the next year or so we will have reached a critical mass of people concerned about it, and that it will start getting a lot more attention. And I think that the other thing that's going to contribute to that is that part of the whole push with EHR and meaningful use and ERA and high tech and all those lovely letters is making information much more readily available to the public. And when patients start seeing things, it's not going to take a whole lot of patients looking at their health data, especially on an HIE level, and seeing problems, that all of a sudden it's going to be the source of a very strong focus. But we're not there yet. We're on the cusp of, I'm going to say, probably at least by the end of Meaningful Use 2, this round 2 of Meaningful Use, we'll have hit the fan.
Nancy, has NAHAM ever conducted studies on the average duplicate rate or the cost of duplicate medical records?
NAHAM did conduct a study back 4 years ago in 2008. The focus of the study was not really on the costs associated with duplicates, but rather on the frequency of them and the contributing factors to the causes of them, as well as what was being done to prevent and resolve them. I don't think anybody really has a good handle anywhere on what the costs, the specific costs are. I have not seen any in-depth studies related to that. In the NAHAM study, there were slightly more than 200 respondents, which kind of disappointed us. I think it was because we really have not yet reached the tipping point on this as a key issue, and that frequently it's perceived to be more of an HIM or medical record issue than a patient access issue. Also, the volunteers that developed the survey are not expert at creating survey tools, and I think our survey was a little too complex, so people just gave up instead of answering it. What we did was we categorized the respondents into high performers and low performers. Both of them really fell in the middle, but we isolated the high performers as those having less than 2% duplicate rate in their MPI, compared to low performers, those reporting a greater than 6%. Of course, it was self-reported. Consultants and experts in advanced probabilistic matching argue that most organizations vastly underestimate the number of duplicates they have in their database, and that, I think, is probably a valid argument, although sometimes they may overestimate them because they're including in their numbers a lot of records that truly do not turn out to be duplicates. But anyway, so we put our patients into the, or our respondents into these two categories, with the desire to see if there were any obvious trends that we could share or derive practical methods from to share with our members. So related to process design, what data should they be collecting and how they should be collecting it, what they should do related to staff education and performance. In other words, how people were trained, how often they were trained, what were they trained on, what were the consequences of poor performance, what happened when there were patterns of duplicate creation by specific individuals, and then what was done for remediation. Who was identifying the duplicates and how were they getting resolved? Those are the things that we were looking to gain information on and share with our members. There were no magic answers, nothing jumped out, no easy answers. There were some patterns, but there was no formula for success that resulted from our survey. But we did see some trends that we determined to be helpful to share with our members, and we've done that through a variety of channels. Probably the most significant one is related to what data fields or what data elements are collected and utilized in patient identification. And there were some characteristics that distinguished high-performing organizations from the poor performers. High-performing organizations did collect Social Security numbers 30 percentage points higher than those that did not. Gender, a little bit of variation, but not much. Date of birth, again, variation, not quite as significant as Social Security number. But other factors such as address and telephone number, utilizing those in identifying patients was a significant factor in increasing success ratios. And also the use of other names or aliases. None of the low-performing organizations were utilizing those in making their matches. Now, it is quite possible that that was a restriction or limitation of the computer systems that they were using. However, it definitely was the most significant distinction between the two. So that's a lesson learned and shared with our members. If you can check on previous variations on people's names, you're going to have a much higher rate of matching, a much more truer match. So that we also did look at items like who identified the duplicates and how they were resolved, and you can extrapolate from that some thoughts related to the expense involved. Although again, we did not do any dollars and cents analysis, but low performing organizations had a higher rate of errors and problems found by nursing and clinical departments. And obviously, if the error has gotten that far into the patient's care, it's going to be more expensive to resolve than if it is found early on in the process. So that also was a distinction that we found in our surveys. As I said, there was no magic bullet or no total trends, but the idea of more is better and having standards, as I alluded to earlier, better data collection, better standards, larger number of data elements that are required in patient identification is going to be helpful, and looking forward to having more national standards related to that. They exist for the UB, but not so much for patient identification. And as I said earlier, the primary focus was on the manual process. What are the policies and procedures you need to have in place? What are the training and education you can do on the forefront? What different questions do you ask your patients? If we were going to be doing this again now, as opposed to 4 years ago when we did, we probably would ask some different questions. At that time, we didn't have the awareness of the technology that's available for assistance, and in fact, there was not as much technology readily available as there is now. So, although there were some pretty advanced matching algorithms out at that time, there was not a lot of market penetration on them, and certainly we did not have the number of biometrics other than photography that we have available to us now. So I would be looking at that as a potential distinguishing point if we were to do a survey again in the future. I would add, though, that although I'm not sure of the number of respondents there were in the CHIME survey, I was disappointed because only 5% of those organizations were using biometrics. Disappointed for a couple of reasons. One is that on a personal level, I would like to see greater penetration in the industry because that helps when one's trying to sell my own organization on it. If I could say, 30% of hospitals are now using biometrics, I'm going to get more attention than, we'll be on the forefront of this, because when one is going for scarce resources, it is certainly a competitive factor. But the other thing that we did note that is helpful, I think, kind of, it takes a village. So when we talk about resolving duplicates, the organizations that had a multidiscipline approach to working them, to resolving them and educating their staff, were much more highly successful than those who delegated the responsibility strictly to HIM or strictly to patient access. So that really kind of summarizes the results from the survey that we did. I look forward to a point in time when we can get good dollars and cents information on the actual costs for duplicates, but we're not there at this time. And again, I know I'm talking quite a bit, but I did want to add, because I thought it was very interesting, because personally, I have been sold on the concept of biometrics since I was first introduced to them. I don't know what number of respondents there were in that CHIME survey, but only about 5% of them were using biometrics. I was very disappointed to hear that, because I'm trying to push my organization to move forward with new technology.
Right.
And it's not going too far. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Just wonderful information. Thank you, Nancy, for sharing all this with us. I did have a question that popped in my mind, actually, about the patient healthcare provider relationship. Just from your own experience, do you find that you mentioned earlier that hospitals in your survey who asked for multiple forms of identification tended to score higher percentage-wise than those that didn't. Do you find, from the patient's perspective, that there's a level of sensitivity to providing multiple forms of identification, or are they generally receptive to that because they know it protects their identity, protects them from having a duplicate medical record created, and protects them from medical identity fraud?
It's my perception that patients are very easily swayed by what is the hot topic in the media. And as a result of that, many patients are no longer willing to share their Social Security number freely. And I understand why, because that is obviously an essential piece that's required for identity theft, not only within the healthcare arena, but out and beyond it. So that particularly has become a very sensitive issue, and a lot of registrations are initiated via the web or a phone call or paper documents that come through the mail, and in those circumstances people are very reluctant to share their Social Security number. Face-to-face, the compliance is better. Other than that, no, people are pretty willing when you explain to them the purpose of collecting the information. People are pretty willing to share. And we're pretty good at blaming it on the government. Why do you need to know that? Well, the government requires it to pay your bill, or your insurance company requires it to pay your bill. So for other data elements, we don't have much resistance.
Okay. Thank you. I wanted to talk briefly with you about some things that can be done to prevent patient misidentification. Once again, you've already touched on a few of those multiple forms of identity. What other things do you think that can be done in the healthcare industry to prevent patient misidentification?
Well, I think that there's a lot of technology that's available to us, even though it isn't, the penetration isn't there yet. So that there is the ability to use advanced probabilistic matching over and above what most people are using as part of their ADT or registration system. That kind of software does exist and is available. In addition to that, the other technologies that I think are very helpful in this arena are smart cards and biometrics. In terms of, and they each have their own benefits. So the advanced probabilistic matching is very helpful, because if you don't have the ability to interact with the patient, like on an HIE level, that would be probably the most appropriate. The advantage that smart cards bring in addition to reducing wait time and positively identifying the patient. They can store basic health information. In fact, I recently heard of an actual study that was conducted, I think it was in New Orleans, where they did an emergency drill, and half of the people had smart cards and half did not, and the ones with the smart cards were able to be triaged and treated in, very rapidly, and then others, obviously, it took a lot more resources to assess and to treat them. So that's an advantage to a smart card. You're carrying your most important aspects of your medical record with you. The downside is the same thing that I just said. You're carrying it. And if you don't bring it, it's not going to help. We already have, I'm going to say, easily 30% of the patients that present in our ERs at least state they don't have identification. We can't go in their wallets to find out. But so I don't know if it's they can't be bothered or if they really don't travel around with their identification. I heard a presentation by a colleague a couple of years ago. She works at a health system that's in beach communities. So when the paramedics bring the patient off the beach, they don't have their wallet. That just stuck with me. So smart cards aren't going to help in an environment like that. Then we go to biometrics. And I don't know anywhere near as much about biometrics as I would like to. However, the obvious advantage of biometrics is that they're always with you. You can't treat a patient that doesn't have a biometric with them, whatever it is, whether it's a palm scan, a fingerprint, or an eye scan. So I can't really speak to the pluses and minuses of any one of those technologies individually, but they would certainly positively identify the patient once they had been properly enrolled in your database. So that becomes the challenge with that is to match that biometric to existing records positively, and there would need to be serious processes put in place to validate ID before they were linked to a biometric for existing records. So I think all those three or any combination of those three, depending on an individual's health system, are all hope for the future. And from the things that I have heard and read, probably would turn out to be a very reasonable investment over time. The challenge, again, being that people don't really know what it's costing them now not to use it.
Okay.
To use what the cost of the present environment is.
Okay, thank you. Finally, I wanted to discuss healthcare information exchanges, which are becoming a very large part of the healthcare industry. What do you feel are some of the issues regarding patient identification across these healthcare information exchanges that are being created?
Well, I think the biggest and most obvious two are that information is being exchanged without the readily available contact with the patient. So if I have a patient sitting in front of me, I can say, oh, did you live at a previous address? Or, oh, were you previously known by another name? When I'm matching information electronically without that interaction, I've got to have more matching data points because I can't get them through conversation. So that's one issue. The other issue is that the size of the database is so huge, or will be so huge, that the probability of having potential mismatches, because the name and the date of birth are the same, or the name and the date of birth and the city and state in which the resident lives are the same. So you either are going to set your matching criteria such that you're going to have a lot of records inappropriately matched that don't belong to each other, false positives, or you're going to set your criteria so stringent that you're going to have a lot of false negatives. So we're not going to know that Nancy Farrington, who lives on J Street in Washington, is the same person as Ann Farrington, who lives in Silver Spring, Maryland, because I'm matching on last name, first name, date of birth, and address. Mm-hmm. Don't match, even though it really is the same person who goes by a nickname and moved since the last encounter. So the problems are going to increase exponentially just purely on that basis of matching. And then when we add the factor of one of the desired outcomes of HIEs is increased use of patient portals, and our patients are going to start seeing this, and then we'll be airing our dirty laundry and having much more of a public outcry, because they'll start realizing things that have been kind of deep, dark secrets within healthcare.
Okay. Well, thank you for all this information. It's been very educational, and we do appreciate your time. And we've been speaking with Nancy Farrington, who is the Enterprise Master Patient Index Administrator for Mainline Health System out of Broomall, Pennsylvania, who also served on the board of the National Association for Healthcare Access Managers and has over 30 years of experience in patient access and patient identification. Nancy, thank you for your time. We really appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing you out at a trade show sometime soon.